dream still unfulfilled? 60 years after civil rights icon Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, "I Have a Dream," a rallying call for racial equality, America is still grappling.
We can't let hate prevail, and it's on the rise. It's not diminished. Silent wave, we've all said many times, silence is complicity. We're not going to remain silent.
Plus, our former U.S. President Donald Trump's mounting legal problems starting to create doubt about his electability from members of his own party?
The majority of my competitors believe that you can have a convicted felon as our nominee for president, and that they'd support that and that he could win. I think that's an impossibility.
And the all-American sport of baseball gaining popularity in one African nation. Today is Tuesday, August 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris met with the family of the late civil rights icon Martin Luther King on Monday's 60th anniversary of the march he led on Washington. On that day, King delivered his famous "I Have a Dream" speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial before a crowd of about 250,000 people, still considered one of the most consequential racial justice demonstrations in U.S. history. It comes as the nation is still reckoning with racism. Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue begins our coverage.
The meeting comes days after a white man shot and killed three black people in Jacksonville, Florida.
We can't let hate prevail, and it's on the rise. It's not diminishing. Silence, I believe, we've all said many times, silence is complicity. We're not going to remain silent.
The president says there is a group of extreme people trying to erase history, and action is needed against hate-fueled violence.
I never thought that I'd be president, let alone be president, and having a discussion on why books are being banned in American schools.
Kamala Harris, the first black person elected vice president, was at the meeting.
The vast majority of us have so much more in common than what separates us.
But President Biden has struggled to fulfill key promises to black voters, perhaps the most loyal group in his political base. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Meanwhile, this past weekend, thousands again converged on the National Mall to commemorate the original march. VOA's Kim Lewis talked about the current state of race relations in America with Nicole Ondal, Senior Vice President for People and Culture at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The heart of healthy race relations, it lies in the ability of different racial groups not to just live together with out general friction, but to understand and respect one another. And that, I believe, is something that is really the thread that carries through a lot of what he had to say. I would say since we lost him and in the last several decades, we have seen exponential improvement in this regard. We used to ignore, you know, our parts of identity and culture and history, and those things have now become part of the public discourse. Blacks and whites and other racial groups, we do live and work in closer proximity, but the racial gap in education is still growing. And I was just recently also reading about his Poor People's Campaign as well. So poverty is a big issue. And stereotyping and polarization is still prevalent between various groups. What I see is, unfortunately, some figures use their bully pulpit to capitalize on these misperceptions and misrepresentations in order to further their own political or economic gain. And even worse are when we have events like Jacksonville, Buffalo, and Charlottesville, which are nothing new in our history. But, you know, it's important to remember that the shooter in Jacksonville may have acted alone. He was part of a group of individuals, a growing group of individuals, I might add, for whom just distrust and hatred isn't enough. They use large-scale public acts of violence to foment racial division and promote their hate.
How can this community now come together with this incident creating more divisions?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot that's going back and forth now where, you know, I think there's a very legitimate public debate happening right now is what were the specific circumstances that led to this individual taking this action? Again, our divisive society and the divisiveness in the way that people talk about issues of race and diversity in the public space. I think, first of all, there has to be responsibility taken when language is used that's designed to divide people. But I also think that if we're going to have an honest conversation about what happened and if this community wants to or has to move forward, you have to look at what were exactly the circumstances that led to this to happen, and then how can the community not lose their voice when everybody else is going to want to talk about this and give their own opinion about why it happened or why they were targeted. Let the community be the one to drive the conversation and let them be the one to say what they need to move on and to heal from this and not dictate it to them.
Nicole Ondahl with the Center for Strategic and International Studies speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis. A federal judge on Monday set March 4th, 2024 as the start date for former President Trump's criminal trial on charges of trying to overturn his 2020 election defeat. The date puts the historic trial right in the middle of the 2024 presidential election, with all polls showing Trump far ahead of his rivals for the Republican nomination. But as VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports, some in his own party are starting to question his electability.
Days after the Atlanta jail booking of former President Donald Trump made headlines around the world, his political ambitions are again under scrutiny. Trump currently faces 91 criminal charges across four indictments. Among his contenders for the Republican presidential nomination, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was interviewed on ABC's This Week's show, suggested that Trump is a liability for his party.
The majority of my competitors believe that you can have a convicted felon as our nominee for president, and that they'd support that and that he could win. I think that's an impossibility.
Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, who alongside Christie participated last week in their party's first debate, acknowledged Trump's achievements when interviewed on NBC's Meet the Press.
I want to build on the foundation that Trump laid. Frankly, I will invite him as an advisor and a mentor. I don't want to relearn the same lessons. I want to pick up where he left off.
Trump's legal problems won't be a part of President Joe Biden's 2024 re-election campaign strategy, the Biden campaign's co-chair, Cedric Richmond, told ABC.
What I will say about President Biden and Vice President Harris is that they have always focused on the American people. So they're going to continue to do their jobs of bringing down costs, raising wages, rebuilding the middle class.
But as President Biden's age continues worrying Democratic voters, independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who appeared on NBC, suggested turning the focus to what's at stake in the policy arena.
Do you believe that women have a right to control their own bodies? Well, the president has been strong on that. Do you think that climate change is real, or do you agree with the Republicans that it's a non-issue?
Meanwhile, Trump, who has denied all wrongdoing, is betting on using his criminal probes to advance his 2024 presidential bid. That includes promoting his mugshot, which is being printed on all kinds of merchandise for fundraising purposes. Veronica Valderas-Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Ukraine said Monday its troops had liberated the southeastern settlement of Robotyn and were trying to push farther south in their counteroffensive against Russian forces. This, as few residents have followed an evacuation order in northeast Ukraine, despite a Russian push to retake the region. Associated Press correspondent Mimi Montgomery reports.
As war returns to Kharkiv province, Ukrainian authorities are ordering mandatory evacuations of villages there, but so far, a majority of residents are refusing to go as battles inch closer. The directive applies to 37 settlements now liberated by Ukraine after being occupied by Russia earlier in the war. But with Russia's attempt to push back into the area, a district military administration is now asking more than 10,000 residents to seek safety elsewhere. For those remaining, many don't want to give up their homes, and some say hardships of relocating and fear of poverty are among reasons for staying. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
Russia says the remains of Yevgeny Prigozhin, leader of the Wagner mercenary group, were confirmed among the dead. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Russian authorities confirmed that an August 23rd fatal plane crash killed Wagner group leader Yevgeny Prigozhin. He was listed as one of seven passengers and three crew members aboard the doomed flight, all of whom were reported dead by Russian state media. Investigators said Sunday that they identified Prigozhin's remains in the crash. Russian Investigative Committee spokesperson Svetlana Petrenko said through molecular genetic examinations, all 10 reported dead in the crash matched the listed flight sheet. The fatal crash came 2 months to the day after Prigozhin led a failed mutiny during which his mercenaries drove to within 200 kilometers of the capital, Moscow. Prigozhin's Wagner mercenaries had been fighting alongside Russian troops in the country's war in Ukraine. At the time, Russian President Vladimir Putin had this to say of the boldest threat to his reign since he took power nearly a quarter century ago.
What we are facing now is treason. Unreasonable ambitions and personal interests led to treachery, state treason, and betrayal of our own people and common cause, which Wagner fighters and commanders fought and died for alongside our units and brigades.
What caused the flight carrying Prigozhin to fall from the sky remains a mystery, but the Pentagon recently shot down one theory explaining the crash.
We don't have any information to indicate right now the press reporting stating that there was some type of surface-to-air missile that took down the plane. We assess that information to be inaccurate.
And while Putin has yet to publicly take credit for involvement in Prigozhin's death, U.S. President Joe Biden says it's unlikely to have happened without Putin's blessing or knowledge. Officially, the Kremlin denies having anything to do with downing the plane as it now continues waging war on Ukraine without one of its key cornerstones in the form of the Wagner Group led by Prigozhin. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Greek authorities reinforced firefighting forces in the northeastern part of the country Monday, where a massive deadly wildfire was burning for a 10th day with no signs of abating. Investigations continue after three U.S. Marines died in an aircraft crash in Australia during military drills off the coast of Darwin in the Northern Territory. 23 people were on board, five are in the hospital in critical condition. And more than 1,000 health experts, including African cabinet members, are in Botswana for the World Health Organization Regional Committee for Africa to discuss health challenges facing the continent. Delegates want the continent to be better prepared for the next pandemic following Africa's poor response to COVID-19. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In March 2022, the Hubble Space Telescope found, with the help of an astronomical effect called gravitational lensing, the farthest star that has been seen so far. The star is nicknamed Arendelle, and it took 12.9 billion years for its light to reach Hubble. But since the universe has been expanding at a rapid rate, the star is now 28 billion light years from Earth and located in the Sunrise Arc galaxy. Now, NASA's Webb Space Telescope has focused on Arendelle to learn more about this ancient star. Webb's observations reveal that the star is classed as a massive B-type star. It is more than twice as hot and about a million times brighter than our sun. Based only on its colors, scientists may have seen clues that Arendelle also has a cool and red companion star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. In the last 2 months, intense rains have triggered landslides and flash floods, causing widespread havoc in India's Himalayan region. A recent study points to changing weather patterns that have made the Himalayans more vulnerable to the changing climate. Anjana Pashricha has a report on villages impacted by the devastation.
Resh Kumar's home collapsed on a night when torrential rain slashed Mancha village in India's mountain state of Himachal Pradesh. There was no electricity. They took torches and saw that huge cracks had appeared in all the rooms. They kept widening. By the morning, his house had fallen. Neighboring villages experienced similar devastation. Many have taken shelter under tents. Maniram recalls that night of terror. They picked up small children and an old woman and fled. By the time they reached town, that land was also sinking and there was waist-deep water. They ran helter-skelter. These families are among hundreds impacted by the unprecedented havoc caused by extreme monsoon rains. Scores have died in the last 2 months. In big towns and small villages, buildings have been reduced to rubble, roads damaged. Authorities have declared the havoc a state disaster. Sansar Chand says it was the worst destruction they have witnessed. It was nature's fury, according to Chand. He said they could not make out whether it was a cloudburst or whether the land sank. A recent study published in the journal Nature says that global warming is bringing more extreme rain and less snow to mountain regions in the northern hemisphere. Study author Mohammed Ombadi says that can make the mountains more dangerous.
Rainfall, unlike snowfall, triggers floods more rapidly, leading to a higher risk of flooding, landslides, soil erosion, and other negative impacts.
These mountain communities have experienced the shifting climate firsthand. They say winter precipitation now comes closer to summer. Ombadi says intensifying rains are impacting the Himalayas more than other mountain regions.
Also, there is a higher rate of melting glaciers. And when you have these two processes, again, acting together, then they amplify the risk of flooding and landslide. For these two reasons, the Himalayas are hotspots that, you know, are vulnerable to global warming and climate change impacts.
Rapid construction of buildings and roads in a region that is a tourist magnet is aggravating the problem, prompting growing calls for sustainable development. But it is already too late for these families. They fear that the hills where they lived for generations are now unsafe. Social worker Chand says that he does not think this area is any longer habitable. There are cracks everywhere till the river. The land has sunk. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Women's rights activists in Israel are increasingly concerned about the new government's moves to separate men and women in public spaces. They also worry that the Supreme Court will fail to protect women. We hear more from Linda Gradstein reporting for VOA from Jerusalem.
When a group of teenage girls dressed in shorts and tank tops recently boarded an Israeli bus, the driver forced them to move to the back of the bus and cover up with scarves. One of them was Elia Lior, who described to Israeli TV channel Kan 11 how it made her feel. These kinds of incidents are not new, but they have become increasingly common as the ultra-Orthodox community and political parties gain more power in the current government. Ilana Stockman is an Israeli feminist who worries about the politicians' ultimate intentions and the tactics of those who support them.
When we think about what the end game is for the religious parties, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that what they're looking at is a woman-free public space in all forms. I mean, we're seeing, just over the past week, we've had a lot of erasures of women's faces and ads. We had, for the first time, ultra-Orthodox men slashing the tires of a public bus because there was a picture of a woman on it. So that's like a whole new level of violence.
The increased challenges to women's rights by the ultra-Orthodox led thousands of women to protest on the streets of Israel's mostly ultra-Orthodox city of B'nai Brak. Many held signs proclaiming gender equality, and some women engaged in arguments with ultra-Orthodox men. The women say they object to attempts by the conservative ultra-Orthodox to impose more restrictions on liberal secular Israeli society. The ultra-Orthodox religious establishment already controls many civil issues like marriage and divorce, and ultra-Orthodox parties in the government now want to expand their influence even more. Orly was one of the demonstrators.
I hope that religion and state will be separated and everyone will be able to live his life the way he wants to live without using the power of religious.
Women's rights activists have been prominent during the 8 months of protests against the current far-right religious Israeli government. Women dressed in the red robes of the dystopian novel and TV series The Handmaid's Tale have been marching in many of the demonstrations, expressing fears about the government's intentions to limit women's freedoms. Orly Erez-Lakovsky of the Israel Religious Action Center, an advocacy group, has no doubt what those intentions are.
This is the most misogynistic government we've ever seen. The coalition members of this government, reading through the coalition agreements, we can see they have very grave intentions of harming women's rights. And I can tell you, as one who have been fighting for women's rights, that we are witnessing one of the most concerning moments in Israel's history for women's rights.
Until now, women's rights activists could count on the Supreme Court to fight against gender discrimination. But they worry that the current government's plan for judicial overhaul that is aimed at weakening the Supreme Court will now make that harder. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Introduced in Nigeria by the U.S. Peace Corps in the 1960s, baseball is slowly becoming a sport of note thanks to the efforts of a few dedicated lovers of the game.
A weekly baseball and softball training for school kids
events is underway in Ekiti State in southwest Nigeria. Baseball coach Oluwafemi Aina started the training camp in 2014 with only 5 baseballs, 2 softballs, and a bat. Now, his team, Ekiti Little League Baseball and Softball, has drawn participants from 6 schools in the state, and Aina says there's not enough playing fields.
We know, you know, the way it was known in the US and other parts of the world, but because of the passion I have for the game, I don't have any option than to just push it. And the major setback of the game is gear and equipment.
In 2002, Aina quit football to join the first baseball training in Ekiti State. And despite many challenges over the years, he says his passion for the game has only grown. In January of this year, he attended Wendelstedt Umpire School in the United States as part of his quest to bring baseball back to Nigeria.
One thing that struck my mind then was they said Little League Baseball is the largest youth organization that have youth participants all over the world. And I tried to Google it and I knew it was true. And that one really ignited my passion and my energy.
Nigeria fielded baseball teams in the 1999 and 2003 All-Africa Games, winning silver medals in both competitions. In April, Nigeria hosted West Africa's first Little League Baseball tournament, which it won. Kunle Adeyemi, the general manager of Ekiti State Sports Council, says such competitions, along with help from local politicians, could usher in new opportunities for baseball in Nigeria.
I can assure you that this new governor will do everything possible to make sure that all these kids, it will make sure that they get to the peak of their career in baseball and softball.
Young stars like Philip Fagbenro say they have big dreams.
In the nearest future, I see myself to excel with my teammates, every one of us, to go higher in the USA.
Emmanuel Olayinka says all they need is an opportunity.
If we should be given a chance, which I believe it will be possible, we like to go out as a team to play outside the country. We are hoping for that.
But first, they'll be working hard to win local sponsors and make the game more popular at home. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a very wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 21st, just hours before the United Nations Security Council held a briefing on the situation in the Middle East, an Israeli woman was shot dead in the West Bank, a stark example of the almost daily violence taking place there and in Israel. The number of Israelis and Palestinians killed in attacks so far this year has surpassed all of last year and is the highest since 2005. In her remarks to the Security Council, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield strongly condemned Palestinian terrorist attacks against Israelis, including the August 21st killing of the woman near Hebron, as well as the earlier August attacks that killed a father and a son outside Huwara and an Israeli police officer in Tel Aviv.
We condemn the reckless launch of rockets by militants in the West Bank, a deeply troubling event, and strongly condemn the terror attacks by settlers in Burqa on August 4th that killed the 19-year-old Palestinian. We note Israel has made several arrests and expect accountability and justice to be pursued with equal vigor in all cases of violent extremism, whether the perpetrators are Palestinian militants or extremist Israeli settlers.
Ambassador Thomas Greenfield urged the parties to take immediate steps to de-escalate and restore calm. She called on Israeli and Palestinian security forces to increase their cooperation to improve the security situation in the West Bank.
And we urge all parties to take proactive measures to counter all forms of violence and incitement to violence and refrain from actions that inflame tensions, including settlement activity, evictions, the demolition of Palestinian homes, terrorism, incitement of violence, and payments to the families of terrorists.
The United States, she emphasized, continues to support a two-state solution for the Palestinians and the Israelis and stands ready to support all efforts to bring that goal closer.
The bottom line is this: Israelis and Palestinians deserve equal measures of security, prosperity, and freedom.
So let's keep at it, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. Let us work together, and let us do everything in our power to advance a comprehensive, just, and lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.